From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Wednesday, September the 23rd, 2020, and we're so glad to have you with us this morning. You're going to be talking with Xander Landon, a political and state house reporter with VT Digger, first off, and he's going to be filling us in on what happened yesterday. The Vermont Senate voted to override the governor's veto of the Global Warming Solutions Act that follows similar action in the Vermont House last week, meaning that bill will become law, and over the governor's objections, we'll be talking to Xander about how all that went down. And later on, I believe we're going to get a call. I was going to open the phone lines between about 9:35 and 10 this morning. I've got someone who wants to talk to us about what he believes is a push-pull by the Milne campaign. Scott Milne is running for lieutenant governor on the Republican ticket. Someone sent me an email this morning, or I saw it this morning. I think it came in late last night, indicating that there was a push-pull going on. We're going to be talking with a person by the name of Gregory Nagorny in the second half hour, probably just for a few minutes. I'd be very interested to hear from other listeners if you've been hearing what sound like push polls from any campaigns. Of course, these are purported to be polls, but really they are questions designed to sort of plant ideas in your mind about a candidate, which is not favorable to that candidate. So we'll be trying to figure out if there actually is a real push-pull going on. And then in the latter hour of the program, after we hear from one of our correspondents from Axios near the top of the hour, just after the top of the hour, we will be going to our regular Wednesday wildlife feature here. We're going to be talking to a couple of hunters and a chef about the joys of hunting and cooking and eating small game in Vermont, everything from squirrels to grouse. And we'll be hearing all about that in the second hour of the program this morning, so I'm looking forward to that. Trouble with talking about food, though, between 10 and 11 a.m. here on the Dave Graham Show. For me, anyways, my stomach starts growling. I hope that isn't audible on the air, but we'll see. Anyway, I wanted to get right into it with Xander Landon this morning. Xander, good morning.
Good morning, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me. And so the big news from the virtual bubble, virtual dome, or whatever we call it, yesterday was that the Senate, it wasn't unexpected, but it was the other shoe dropping here, as has to happen in the legislature, and both houses of the legislature get a crack at things, and the Senate followed the House action last week. The House was actually more suspenseful, wasn't it?
I'm not sure it was, if you've been sort of following this issue over the last couple of years in the House. I don't think there was ever too much worry that Democrats that they wouldn't be able to override a veto on this. There's sort of always been overwhelming support for the Global Warming Solutions Act. Certainly in the Senate, I don't think there was any really question either. It's sort of interesting. I mean, we saw some really sort of much tighter, much more harrowing override attempts for Democrats earlier this year, before the pandemic. Feels like a long time ago now. With minimum wage increase and paid family leave, the House Democrats failed by one vote to successfully override that. And then there was a successful override of a minimum wage increase that's going to take effect. I think it's important to note that override of gubernatorial vetoes in Vermont do not happen very frequently. So it's rare to have an issue where a party can get two-thirds majority needed to reverse governor's veto pen. So this was sort of an instance where there wasn't too much concern about Democrats getting the support they needed. Yesterday's vote was 22-8 in the Senate. You had the six Republicans in the Senate opposing and two Democrats as well. But the rest of the Senate was on board, as you said, this will become law now, and will mandate the state to meet pretty strict emissions reductions targets in the coming years.
Which were the two Democrats who voted not to override the veto?
It was John Rogers, Senator John Rogers, and Senator Bobby Starr, both from Essex, Orleans counties.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask. That's interesting that these two senators from one of the most rural districts in the state would be the two Democrats. And you know, one of the criticisms I've heard of some of the measures that people talk about with climate change and with the efforts to stem climate change, these would be costly to folks in rural areas who typically are driving longer distances than somebody, you know, who lives in South Burlington and works at Burlington or whatever. Is some of that coming into this? Is it more of a cultural thing, or what do you think prompted those two Democrats to cross over?
Yeah, I think we've heard from both of them in the past sort of opposition to measures like a carbon tax, you know, increasing the cost of fuel prices, which is, you know, something that many politicians in the state and, as you say, rural parts of the state where, you know, obviously in the entire state of Vermont, we're all dependent on cars much more than, you know, maybe some other parts of the country where there's sort of more built out public transportation infrastructure. So there's definitely a lot of anxiety about potential measures that would come out of this, you know, this legislation that could increase the cost of living, the cost of transportation on people that need, you know, to rely on their vehicles. I will note that, you know, there's nothing, the thing that sort of, is interesting about this measure or this legislation, the Global Warming Solutions Act, is that it doesn't contain any specific policies for how the state is going to reduce its carbon footprint in the coming years. And it leaves a lot of the planning process for how that's going to happen, really the entire planning process, up to this climate council that's going to basically be formed. And it includes 23 members, including, you know, state government officials, representatives from the manufacturing sector, so citizen experts, et cetera, that's going to come up with a pollution reduction plan. And a lot of it will have to be approved by lawmakers. It won't be sort of this council is going to have a unilateral authority to just say, you know, we're going to have a carbon tax in the next 5 years, or we're going to, you know, ban a certain type of engine or et cetera. It doesn't have that kind of authority. A lot of its recommendations are going to go to the legislature for their approval. But the governor and a lot of Republicans have been concerned about, you know, in their view, sort of abdicating a lot of the decision-making process to this council and not having the legislature come up with these sorts of ideas, you know, itself. And that's been one of the big criticisms of this legislation. And in addition, I should note that the bill will also make it clear and allow for lawsuits against the state if it does not meet these emissions targets in the coming years. And so, for example, by 2025, this law would mandate that the state cut its emissions 26% below what they were in 2005, and that's so the state basically has 3 years to make some strides in doing that. And if it doesn't hit that mark, then a group or an individual could bring suit against the state to sort of force it into compliance. And I think Democrats are making clear that, well, we're not going to allow, you know, there to be sort of monetary damages as a sort of a stick or a punishment for the state to not, if it doesn't meet those levels, that target. But there is definitely concern. I mean, that's been a big point of concern, that's been raised by Republicans and the governor when he was just detailing why he couldn't support the bill, that he didn't want the state to get caught up in lawsuits that could be costly and take up time, et cetera. Those are the sort of two big reasons why people are not necessarily, Republicans and some Democrats are not on board with this.
that delegation of authority, anything the Climate Council did, though, of a major policy impact would have to be approved by the legislature following on, wouldn't it?
That's right. Yep.
So I think that may help to alleviate some of the concerns about this delegation of authority. Obviously, the Climate Council, I think the idea here being that they would be steeped in these issues and really up to speed on what the latest science is on climate change and et cetera and various methods to try to mitigate it. They could come up with various policies, but the final decision on anything like a carbon tax or anything similar to that would have to be go through the normal process, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
And on the subject of litigation, I wondered, and I asked actually Speaker Mitzi Johnson about this when she was on the program on Monday, you know, it seems as though a lot of the impetus for this Global Warming Solutions Act is the idea that the legislature has come up with these goals years ago. The executive branch has not been real eager to meet the goals or has been, let's just say, unsuccessful in meeting the goals. And this is an effort to sort of add on to pressure, I guess, of adding the judicial branch to the chorus saying we got to do something. But if the response has been foot-dragging to the legislative branch, why wouldn't it just be more foot-dragging in response to the judicial branch, especially when no penalties ensue?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think that there was definitely a feeling from you know, the Democratic Party in the legislature that, you know, we've sort of tried putting targets, the state's tried putting targets to meet for in terms of the, you know, reduction of pollution, reduction of carbon emissions into law before, but we've never met them, right? They've only been sort of stated goals and stated priorities, and that, you know, there was a big push and a lot of talk about needing to have a provision or provisions that would really allow for accountability to sort of allow the, you know, citizens to be able to hold the government accountable to meeting these requirements. Now, how this will play out in practice, I'm not sure. To what extent the ability to sue and force the government into compliance, or, you know, to force it to take action if it hasn't already, to what extent that will be successful if it comes to that, I don't know. But I think politically there was a lot of interest in giving these sort of mandates or giving these sort of requirements or goals or targets, really, some teeth that there hadn't been before.
Earlier on in this debate, back around maybe just before the beginning of the pandemic or whatever, I remember more conservative groups arguing that this is some kind of a sleight of hand by legislators, that what they really wanted to do was to have a carbon tax and that they were going to delegate the authority to bring one about to either the courts or this council or somebody else so that they wouldn't get blamed. And I remember talking to a couple of the longtime environmental sort of champions in the Democratic caucus about this, and they said, no, we've been very clear with our constituents. We support a carbon tax, and we have for years, and we've told our constituents that. Our constituents seem to like the idea, and so there's no sleight of hand here. This is really what we're about. And I don't know. What do you think, Xander? Was there any effort to pull the wool over voters' eyes here, or is it pretty straightforward?
I really don't know if there's enough support to do something like the carbon tax in the Vermont legislature. I mean,
that's the other aspect. Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, even among Democrats, I mean, the only thing, you know, I've been covering the state house for the last 3 years, and the only real attempt to increase, the tax on fossil fuels that has been made was last year when there was an attempt to raise the tax on fuel to increase investment in weatherization, and that passed the House, but it didn't pass the Senate because the Senate was concerned about that, about raising that tax, I believe concerned that it was sort of a regressive policy. So I think it would be much tougher than I think a lot of people on the right may say in Vermont to actually get the political will to make that happen. To raise a carbon tax, to get money to invest in carbon emissions goals or carbon emissions reduction efforts. That may be, but as maybe they're suggesting, that could be different if you have a 21-member, independent body recommending, making a recommendation that says, the best way to reduce emissions is going to be to tax carbon at a higher rate. And that could change the calculus, absolutely, I think. If you have the group sort of, that's sort of been given the authority to make recommendations on this, making a recommendation.
Wanted to bring in a listener who's on the line. Ron from Middlesex, I believe, is calling in. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. First of all, this is a completely personal thing. I will say I'm on our regional plan, representative on our regional plan council for Middlesex. Well, this is not political or anything else. Two questions. One is, since a lot of our global warming and a lot of our carbon reduction is going to involve Hydro-Quebec, has anyone worried about the amount of land that's going to have to be flooded out, maybe indigenous land in Canada to meet this? That's question number one. And question number two, what happens if the only way to meet these reductions is to increase wind power, which we seem to have a problem doing? So that's my two questions.
Ron, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Sandra, what are people saying about the various sources of renewable energy that we talk about in terms of replacing fossil fuels, especially, in our electrical grid? There are problems connected with virtually every form of generating energy. A years-long controversy over the giant hydro dams in Quebec and their impacts on native peoples up there, and as well as wildlife, et cetera. And, of course, there's a lot of opposition to ridgetop wind towers right here in Vermont. How do those debates kind of connect with this and fit into the mix?
They haven't really, been a large part of this debate. I think that's maybe because in the last 10 years, we haven't been able to, our current efforts to expand renewables in the state haven't been able to sort of been strong enough to help us, meet the stated goals that we've had in statute for carbon emissions reductions. I think that there is just a feeling that, there needs to be an independent group, a group of experts that comes up with the specific advisory capacity to sort of help lawmakers through the decision making about where the focus is going forward in terms of building out the renewable energy sector. I mean, there's there hasn't been much discussion in this process about, do we focus on hydro? Do we focus on wind? It's more just been about creating a sort of a framework to move forward, and leaving a lot of the specific recommendations up to this 21-member or 23-member council that will be formed. To answer that question, the specific, where do we focus question is I think going to be left up largely to that body, that independent body.
Yeah, and many debates to come, I'm sure, in that context, because this council will surely get a lot of attention as it goes forward. But again, I think it's worth emphasizing again, from my understanding of this legislation, the council would be more advisory. It wouldn't have the ability to enact policy on its own. Policies would have to still be put before through the traditional process of going through the legislature, being supported by the governor, or having a gubernatorial veto overridden. that's the way the system works now. Hey, just a few minutes to go, Xander, and I did want to touch on the some poll results that came out yesterday. Interesting stuff, not particularly good news for David Zuckerman, the Democratic candidate for governor. Looks like Phil Scott has a big lead. What tell us about this?
Yeah, that's pretty much the boiled down version of it. The poll that was released by Vermont Public Radio and Vermont PBS yesterday shows Phil Scott with a 31% lead. I believe it was 55% to 24%. And, the poll also showed that a lot, more Democrats are supporting Phil Scott than Zuckerman. It was about 48% of Democrats saying they would vote for the governor, incumbent governor, and 41% saying they would vote for David Zuckerman. And I think you could pretty much attribute a lot of that. I mean, the Democrats sort of on the more moderate end of the spectrum have for a long time supported Phil Scott in gubernatorial elections. But I think that, it's likely that the COVID-19 crisis has only increased his favorability among Democrats. Last month, there was a poll that showed that 83% of Vermonters approve of the governor's response to the pandemic. So it's no surprise that he's doing very well in the polls. And I spoke with David Zuckerman yesterday just to sort of get his reaction, his thoughts. And he said that, this poll was sort of taken, the survey went out in early September before a lot of people had really been thinking about this upcoming election and the governor's race. They've been really focused on COVID-19. So maybe they've been sort of looking to the governor and his reaction or his response a little more than they normally would. In a normal year. And he also noted that, in the coming weeks, there are going to be a lot of debates. He recently, this past weekend, launched a TV ad. I just heard an ad on WDTV here for David Zuckerman during the commercial break. So there's a lot of, time for more sort of opportunities for him to draw contrast with the governor. So that's his sort of line there. And I would also add that the poll, another thing very interesting the poll showed in the lieutenant governor's race is a very tight race between Democrat Molly Gray and Republican Scott Mill, and it's 4% difference. She had 35%, he had 31%, but there's a 4% margin of error, so you got a statistical tie in the lieutenant governor's race right now.
Wow, that is interesting. Do you think that the Governor Scott is being helped by President Trump in a weird way, which he has not been friendly to President Trump? And, are some Vermonters saying, I want to support a good Republican, quote unquote?
Yeah, I think that definitely he gets some points, among Democrats for drawing contrast between himself and Donald Trump and being a vocal critic, really one of a few Republicans that's sort of willing to openly criticize the president as much as he has in a state where President Trump is very unpopular. Yeah, I definitely think that's going to earn him some points with Democratic voters.
Interesting. Xander Lynn at avtdigger.org, thank you so much for joining me this morning. It's good talking with you. Let's get together again soon.
Thanks, Patrick.
All righty. We're going to take a brief break for some CBS News at the bottom of the hour. When we come back, we're going to open the phone line to take some listener calls, and we'll be back in a couple minutes, folks.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Dilly takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We're back. We want to open the phone lines this half hour and have listeners weigh in on what they would like to talk with us about this morning. There's a heck of a lot of news nationally, locally here in Vermont. Of course, new poll results out yesterday from the public broadcasting systems, and as well as the Senate's decision yesterday to override the veto of Governor Scott of the Global Warming Solutions Act, meaning that will take effect as law in Vermont. There is some criticism of the law out there. It's not a slam dunk with everybody for sure. So happy to take calls from listeners about that or anything else that's on your minds this morning. We do have a caller on the line. Greg Nagorny is checking in with us. He says that he was the recipient of a phone call, I guess last evening, which sounded to him like a push poll. And Gregory, first off, where are you calling from, and then tell us what happened.
I live in Waterbury, Dave. So I got a phone call last night. It rang through. I was on for about 15 minutes with the pollster. It was a West Burke number. Looks like it came through, according to my call log, from a number 553-3066. And it was very clearly a push-pull. It wasn't just a pull. It was very clearly designed. And actually, they were up front and told me it was sponsored by the Milne campaign. But the poll was very clearly designed to paint Scott in a positive light and prejudice Molly Gray. Questions along the lines of, am I aware that Scott's a hardworking business owner and that his mother served proudly in the legislature and he's an independent, but does that make me more or less likely to vote for him? And by the same token, does the fact that Molly Gray supports legalization of sex work to be, and that that would cause, you know, trafficking and child pornography and these horrible things to occur, does that make me more or less likely to vote for her? It was fairly blatant. There wasn't much artifice there. It was pretty upfront about what it was. And I actually called the pollster out on it, and she just sort of laughed at me and kept going with the questions. So it was pretty interesting. And I guess I alerted you to it simply because I hear an awful lot in Vermont that the Vermont Republican Party isn't the same as the National Republican Party, but the Vermont Republican Party is different. And in this case, that's very clearly not true. This is something that reminded me an awful lot of the Bush campaign's efforts in 2000 in South Carolina against John McCain.
Yeah, it's interesting how sometimes a campaign call will masquerade as a polling call, and the object of the game obviously is to implant in your mind, in the call recipient's mind, ideas like this candidate or that candidate supports policies which would have the following horrible effects, and so on and so forth, and it's said to be pretty effective. A lot of political scientists out there talk about push polls as being a fairly effective strategy. It sounds like it didn't work with you too well.
I think the feature of it that really interested me the most was they were really interested up front in figuring out what my registered party affiliation was and where that left me. And they wanted to know whether I considered myself conservative, moderate, or liberal within my party affiliation. And I noted after that the questioning was really tailored to that. So, for example, they asked me, what were my top issues? And, you know, was I aware that, you know, it was a choose your own adventure sort of a thing. But for push polling, you know, it was well scripted, and it was, frankly, it was well done. But it's really concerning.
Well, I have one question.
You hope we don't have here.
Yeah, one question about the script. You said they asked you which party you were registered with. That surprises me in Vermont, given that we don't have formal party registration here. Do you think this was maybe written out of state somewhere?
It well could have been. I know only that the number rang through from West Burke, and it was they identified themselves as some sort of polling organization, and they were careful to say several times that they were completely independent and nonpartisan. But you know, words are deeds and words, you know.
Well, I am curious, Greg, and I want to put the question out to our listeners right now. Have anyone else out there received calls like this, where someone is calling up asking questions that seem very favorable to Phil Scott and Scott Milne, and very unfavorable to the Democratic candidate, in this case, in the lieutenant governor's race, Molly Gray? And folks out there, have you heard these kinds of phone calls? Are you taking them? A lot of people these days, of course, screen their calls and ignore stuff like this. But I guess some people still pick them up, which is why people spend the money to get these calls made. So interesting development out there. I actually was looking around. I was trying to figure out there is a proposal, I think, afloat in the legislature. It doesn't look like it's going to be enacted this year to legalize, to some degree anyway, sex work in Vermont. And I guess one of the criticisms of that idea is that it can tend to promote pornography or the other shadier and negative and terrible, frankly, aspects of this kind of world. And I wonder, I'm not sure. I was looking around online trying to figure out. I don't know the answer to the question as to which of the candidates supports that legislation or does not support the legislation. Have any of them taken positions on it? Do you happen to know, Greg, or have you followed this closely enough?
No, I don't, and I frankly don't even have an opinion on it. It just seemed like such a preposterous route of entry to try to win over someone who may have been an undecided voter.
There is a proposal out there which it seems as though it's a fairly nation thing. I mean, it's fairly new and untested and undebated, really, that needs to be, would have to be fleshed out, I'm sure, and also would have to be really, you know, given some serious consideration over time. And many ideas like this in the Vermont legislature percolate for a couple of years before they even take really serious consideration by the legislature. So it's conceivable it could happen with this thing. So maybe it's worth asking the question. I may have to do that as I talk to the candidates in the coming weeks. But we will see how it all sugars off, as they say. And thank you for the call, Gregory. I really appreciate you checking in with us.
Yeah, thank you, Dave. I appreciate your time.
All righty.
Take care.
244-1777 is the local number in Waterbury, 1-877-291-8255. Anybody else out there hearing what they think are push polls? Are people calling you up and asking, are you really going to vote for this terrible candidate? Or that kind of stuff. Let's go to another listener checking in with us, Fred from Newbury. Good morning, Fred.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Well, let's see here. You're talking about carbon free power. It looks right now that the hydrogen fuel cell could be the answer. Carnegie Mellon is doing research on it, and they're saying that if they can get the cost down to about $30 a kilowatt, then the hydrogen fuel cell would probably be the name of the game. But right mm-hmm. now, it's a bridge too far. But right now, it's a bridge too far. They have to do a lot of work on it to this point. But you can scale them up as far as you want, or you can scale them down.
Yeah, you know, I've been hearing about hydrogen fuel cells probably since the 1990s as this sort of holy grail for folks who want to make lots of energy without a whole lot of environmental impact. I hope it works out someday. I would say that this is in one of those very still speculative categories of maybe. We'll see. I'm glad some universities are trying to work on this stuff, and every now and then I read an article about hydrogen fuel cells and the latest developments, and that's one of the problems connected here is that what they've got so far, and this is often the case with new technology, you know, the first prototypes of whatever we're going to end up with are very, very expensive, and you wait until it gets into mass production before it becomes economical and so on. So that's a fairly typical path for new technologies. I don't know. I am not running out today to invest in hydrogen fuel cell companies. Maybe I'll regret that in 10 years or 20 years or something when I could have been a billionaire. But I guess I will have to just suffer the consequences of my own conservative approach to that kind of thing. We'll see. 40, that's a big we'll see.
40 years ago, you never thought you'd be a smart telephone, did you?
I mean, 40 years ago, we probably thought that the Betamax was going to be a huge thing. There are technologies which are in development and get a lot of conversation and even a lot of customers for a brief period, and then they fizzle. So, and then there are others which are in development for a while, and they have fits and starts, and eventually maybe they emerge as the next big thing. But, you know, that's the nature of the beast with this kind of thing. I wish them well. If they have a solution to where we're going to get our energy and minimize the impact on the environment, whether it's climate change or any, you know, pollution, anything else connected with the generation of this energy. I mean, one thing that's occurred to me over time is that just about every form of energy has its downsides. You know, we talk about nuclear. Well, you got to deal with the radioactive waste. We talk about wind power. You got to deal with the fact that you're building roads up mountainsides and putting these big wind towers on top of mountains. A lot of people don't like the aesthetics there. We talk about pretty much, you know, fracking and gas extraction problems connected with that from the point of view of water quality and so on. So I have yet to learn about a source of energy other than, say, the sun, or maybe something like geothermal in places. Go ahead.
The downside of the hydrogen cell is water. That's the waste.
Water is the waste, and clearly, you know, it's exciting to think about. I hope it works, you know. But again, they've been at it for a good 20 years now, and we're still. It doesn't feel like, unless you know more than I do about this, Fred, which maybe, you know, wouldn't surprise me, but it doesn't feel like we've made a world of progress. We'll see. We'll see what comes in the coming years. So I got to move along, but thank you for the call, Fred. Interesting thought about hydrogen fuel cells as a possible source of energy. And they do have an attraction, which is that they apparently can be either very small. I've heard of people talking about them powering a vehicle or providing energy for a household, or you can add, you know, stack them up, I guess, and power a whole city or a factory or whatever you got. So it's a very scalable technology. I believe we have Bill from Barry with us. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Dave. what about the breeder reactor? Now, I don't know if you've heard about them. I've heard about them for over 60 years. They reprocess the waste. It's right now down at Vernon. They can reprocess and then send it back. That is my solution. They're outlawed in this country right now. But that's, and they were outlawed a few years ago, and I won't go into that detail, but they're using breeder reactors in France and in China and other countries. They also now have small reactors, smaller than the reactors that are in nuclear submarines. And if they allowed the breeder reactors and these smaller reactors that can be put in a small area, like an acre, that's a solution. It's not the complete solution, but that's one solution, but it's politically incorrect.
Yeah, well, I mean, the biggest concern I understand about breeder reactors is that there's a worry about nuclear fuel being used to make bombs, and the United States obviously has been very interested over the years in fancy word non-proliferation, meaning they don't want a whole bunch of countries and non-state actors, meaning typically terrorist groups or whatever, from getting their hands on used nuclear fuel. And that's the concern. That's why the United States.
Do you want to hear my answer?
Sure.
Those countries have already gotten a hold of them. China has the breeder reactor. China and countries like that. My God. So the bad guys already have it. So we won't have it, but they have it. So what you just said has happened. So all these bad countries, like North Korea, already have things like that. They have that technology. We aren't using that technology so that we won't make them mad. But they've already got it, and we don't. That is stupid.
Well, I get you, and obviously, I mean, maybe the horse has left the barn already on this stuff, but, you know, I think the nightmare scenario is for an outfit like, you know, Al-Qaeda or, you know, ISIS or somebody to get their hands on this technology, and that would be...
They could get it from Iran. They could get it from North Korea. They could get it from people in those countries.
Yep.
We... having it isn't going to stop it. We're the guys that went down to Oak Ridge, Tennessee, invented the breeder reactor. I use the word invented, discovered it.
Yeah.
And here
well,
we
one
are.
Of the,
our technology is being used by these bad countries.
Yeah. And by the way, I don't mean to say I'm alterably opposed here, but I like to give you a little pushback just to make you realize what the counterarguments are and have listeners realize that too. The last thing that I hear about this on this question is for instance, the applicability issue. I mean, I guess if we all go to electric cars, maybe this question will be answered by that, but generally, in Vermont anyway, and in a lot of other states now, people are less concerned about electricity generation as a support of carbon, as a source of carbon pollution, as frankly, solar has come up in a big way, wind to some extent, other renewable electricity has really our best success, I guess I should say, to date, in developing renewable energy has come in the electricity sector. What remains is heat, is building heating and industrial processes where you need heat. And the other thing, the other huge one that remains for a difficult challenge in terms of using renewable energy is in transportation. So the biggest...
Okay. Yeah, let me just continue. Electricity could be produced by nuclear and electric cars. But here's the thing. These little nuclear plants take very little space compared to solar and wind and these other things that haven't, you know, that we're using, but they're not as practical, they're not as efficient. And we've pretty well proven that we can do the nuclear safely, especially with the breeder reactor taking out and eliminating the bad waste. Once a power plant has used up the reprocessed fuel, that stuff, the half-life, is shortened to a point that's almost safe. Nothing is completely safe, but it's something, and they're just throwing it out because it's politically incorrect.
Yeah, all right, well...
You guys, I mean, I have a good point. I mean, I was never on a nuclear sub. I do know people who were, and they weren't worried. I know a lot more people who were on aircraft carriers. I know pilots who are on aircraft carriers, and they didn't worry about it one bit.
All right, Bill, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. That's an interesting thought there about breeder reactors as a source of plentiful and inexpensive energy. It would be quite a change in policy for the United States, but we have been known to make big policy changes in the recent past, and so who knows? Maybe this is a coming thing. 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. We are maybe just time for one more quick call here. We are fast approaching the top of the hour on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. And actually, in that last minute, I might want to mention, haven't done this in a couple of days, so I'm a little behind, but our podcast is a service that a lot of people tell me they like a lot because folks are often busy between 9 and 11 a.m. on weekday mornings when we are live here on WDEV FM and AM. But they enjoy going to the podcast. You can go to the WDEVradio.com. That's the homepage of the station's website. You can click from there to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a bit. You'll come up with a list of our recent programs by topic and by guest. And you will be able to tune into whichever topic and guest interests you the most right off the bat. That's the way to go if you want to listen to our show any time of day or night. Of course, you can't call in the off hours, but you can certainly listen and get caught up with what we have been up to. We are heading into this CBS News break at the top of the hour here. We'll be talking with Steph Kite from Axios just after the break for a little bit, and then we're going to get into a conversation about hunting small game in Vermont, and we'll be talking about all that in the second hour. Stay with us, folks.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Dilly takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
Thanks for staying with us into our second hour here of the Dave Graham Show on this Wednesday morning, September the 23rd, 2020. And we are going to be speaking, I think, momentarily with Steph Kite of Axios. Axios is a terrific online news site that is well worth checking out at axios.com. That's AXIOS.com. And they do really nice work on the national news scene out there. Very tightly written stuff. They don't waste words. And you can quickly be brought up to date on what the top stories are. I get an email from them in the morning that talks about their top editor's sort of top 10 list for the day. And I find it very helpful just in terms of if I'm sort of saying to myself, so what are the big stories today anyway? It's a good program that they have to help folks understand really, the most important stuff going on out there in the big bad world. And Mike Allen is their editor, who every morning gets up at the crack of dawn or before dawn or something and cranks out a whole lot of copy. Worries about Wall Street fearing an election meltdown is tops on Mike Allen's list. Hollywood is starting to make movies again, getting back in business there. That's been a real dearth during the coronavirus pandemic. So we are absolutely wondering what's next on the movie front. We're coming into awards season, and I don't know how they're going to pull off an Academy Awards this coming winter when there've been such little production of films in 2020. That's going to be a challenge, I'm sure. So we'll be talking with Steph Kite from Axios. I do believe if we can get connected with her in just a moment or two, one of the things that on Mike Allen's list this morning, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death and the fight over her replacement are amplifying Wall Street worries about major volatility and market losses ahead of or even after the election. That's this is from Axios Markets editor Dion Rabuin, I think, or something like that. The 2020 election is the most expensive event risk on record per Bloomberg, which, with insurance bets on implied volatility six times their normal level, according to JP Morgan analysts. It's amazing how they're taking out insurance on Wall Street investments. There's just layers upon layers of risk and attempts to buy down that risk in that world of Wall Street investors. It's amazing how that whole system kind of builds upon itself over time. Then they talk about on Axios this morning, the Supreme Court fight will compound partisanship and division in the event of a contested election, analysts at TD Securities say in a note to clients. So Wall Street also, trying to basically hedge their bets on the politics. What's going to happen with the Supreme Court fight? What's going to happen, obviously, with the upcoming election? That's going to be a concern and a consideration for Wall Street, because they're always looking for things to be worried about. That's the that seems to be the case there. We have trouble tracking down Steph Kite, so what we're going to do is we're going to take another brief break here on the Dave Graham Show and see if we can work that out. We'll be back in just a moment, folks.
At Make-A-Wish Vermont, we've got a million things on our minds.
A million? That's a really big number.
That's because right now, we're out to raise over a million frequent flyer miles for our Wishes in Flight program.
It would take like a whole hour to count that high.
Donating your miles is easy, and each mile goes to making wishes come true for deserving children right here in Vermont.
I wish to speak Japanese to Japanese people in Japan.
Children's wishes can take them lots of places, and so can you. By donating your miles to Wishes in Flight. So, will you help us raise a million or more frequent flyer miles?
How about a million, billion, bazillion miles?
We'd take that too. Please visit wishesinflightvt.org to donate your miles. Once donated, miles never expire, so you know each mile will go to making a deserving Vermont child's wish come true. So come on, visit wishesinflightvt.org today.
Now say thank you.
Thank you. Sponsored by People's United Bank.
Now you can take WDEV with you on the go with the WDEV mobile app. Wait a second. What's all this?
It's a new mobile app, Ken.
A mobile what?
You know, you download it on your phone and you can listen to us live. Check sports schedules, listen to the Dave Graham Show.
Perhaps music to go to the dump.
Yes, music to go to the dump by.
You'll have to help me put this all together.
While we help Ken catch up with 21st century technology, download the WDEV mobile app on the App Store or Google Play.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Back, and I'm going to ask if we have been successful in tracking down Steph Kite from Axios. Do we have Steph with us?
Hello.
Maybe not. Hello, Steph.
I'm here.
Okay. Glad to hear that. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing all right. What are the top stories on your radar screen this morning?
Well, you know, one of the top screens that we're looking at right now is just how Wall Street is reacting to the meltdown over the Supreme Court and looking at the election this year when my colleagues reported on how, you know, the Ruth Bader Ginsburg passing and President Trump vowing to name her replacement to the Supreme Court before the election is really, it's really amplifying Wall Street's worries about the volatility and market losses ahead, just given everything going on and given the concern over the election being even challenged potentially in November.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, obviously an election that does not go off as smoothly as we hope would be perhaps a big worry to Wall Street investors. But part of me wants to ask sort of how do they calculate the need to get worried from obviously it's a sad thing to have Ruth Bader Ginsburg die. I'm sorry to see the loss of this much-loved Supreme Court justice, but why does that have an effect on Wall Street, I guess? That's my bottom line question.
No, I think a lot of this comes down to just, you know, the risk they're seeing at just the country in general being in this volatile state where there's so much concern over elections where people are going to be untrustworthy, and all of that impacts the stock market in particular. And so they're expecting, because of the chaos, because of the uncertainty, because of concerns that uncertainty could then impact the economy, all of that comes together just to create a very uncertain, an uncertain market. And that's where a lot of people are concerned, given all these new changes on top of the pandemic. Those all compound on one another.
Okay, well, one of the chief sources of uncertainty surrounding this election, I think, is statements by President Donald Trump that if he doesn't win, he will assume that the election has been rigged or fixed or he was cheated out of his victory or whatever. So maybe he is the source of a lot of the problem here in terms of the uncertainty of what might happen. I mean, in a normal U.S. election season, You have a couple of candidates, a Republican and a Democrat. They're squaring off against one another, having a robust debate. You have an election. There's a smooth transition of power in the following January. All of that, one assumes, is not incredibly concerning or worrying to Wall Street. This time, it might be more of a worry in no small part because of what the president is doing and saying. And yet, the president takes huge pride in what he thinks of as the, or what he talks about all the time is Wall Street's excellent performance. So why would a guy who is staking a lot of his political capital on the successful performance of Wall Street want to cause Wall Street to have all of these shakes and rattles?
Yeah, well, I'm sure, you know, President Trump doesn't think that what he says is actually impacting Wall Street as much as it maybe is. You know, I think President Trump is, he has his eyes on November, and he's going to do whatever it takes to win in November. And we've seen that with the way he talks about vote by mail and the way he's kind of shifted from warning people from voting by mail to then, you know, putting it, making it easy for people to apply for absentee ballots, even directing people to applications through his own website. But yes, all of that, that does add to the concerns in the moment. And President Trump's kind of, you know, back and forth reckless behavior certainly does impact the markets. And we've seen that throughout his presidency this far. I'm sure we're going to see it over the next few months as he continues to campaign and as we continue to see the campaign season heat up and we see the debates play out and how those debates impact people's likelihood to vote for Joe Biden or Donald Trump. All of that's going to continue to move markets, especially as we look at whether or not we'll get some kind of another stimulus package. That's another big factor in all of this. The economy is going to be suffering because of the pandemic far into the future. And so a lot of people are watching to see what the race, how races play out in the Senate and the House as well, and how that could shape the kind of funding we get even for the election in November.
Well, it's going to be a bumpy ride, I'm sure, but we'll have to hang in there and see how it all turns out. Steph Kite of Axios, thank you so much for joining me this morning. It's a great talking with you.
Thanks for having me.
Alrighty. We're not going to be talking politics for the next 45 minutes here on the Dave Graham Show. We occasionally like to switch it up and talk about things like hunting in Vermont. In fact, every Wednesday I've been trying to nudge the Department of Fish and Wildlife into talking to us about what is going on the wildlife front, because I know an awful lot of folks here in WDEV listener land care a lot about what is happening with our wildlife out there, both because they want to hunt them or because they want to preserve them, or many, many different motivations for the interest, but there's keen interest. So good example of three folks here, actually a good team. They're going to be coming up in succession. We're going to do one at a time here over the next few minutes, and we are going to be speaking first with John Gaunter, who is a hunter and hunter educator, about small game hunting in Vermont and the joys of going out there after squirrels and other small game in the state. And I believe John is on the phone with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Dave. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you, and I thank you very much for checking in with us. Small game hunting. I mean, most people, when they think about hunting in Vermont, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is deer hunting, and obviously some people hunt bears and moose and turkeys and other stuff. But you are someone who is, I think, more in the small game. Well, do you hunt large game, or is small game really purely your thing?
I try to hunt large game, but I think as someone who picked up hunting just a few years ago, I started with small game for practical reasons. Squirrel hunting in particular is doesn't require dogs. It doesn't require tree stands. And in some cases, I would say doesn't require a ton of research to figure out where to go. So that was really how I got started. I do hunt turkeys, and I make some effort to hunt deer, but I'm not that successful with that yet.
Yep, I see that you are a skilled squirrel hunter, though, and I am interested to find out what is it that attracts you to that particular animal as a target?
Well, I'll make a short story out of this. So when I picked up hunting about 6 years ago, I was driven by the curiosity of a cook. I've been, well, not a professional. I've been a cook all my life and had really worked in, you know, the last 15 years to get closer and closer and closer to the source of my food. I started fishing again and harvesting and cooking my own fish. And so when I decided to take up hunting, a big part of that was to explore flavors that I haven't worked with. And in North America, a lot of wild game can only really be eaten if you hunt it yourself. It can't be resold. So squirrels were an obvious good place to start. Gray squirrels in particular are very plentiful in Vermont. They're they tend to be quite common on the edges of areas where people live, so finding them is not necessarily as difficult as other game species. And they're actually fairly easy to work with from a cook standpoint, I would say. They're very high quality meat, and there's a lot of different things you could make out of them. So that was really why I chose to start there. And then I think what got kind of funny is I actually wasn't really successful for the first few years. I spent a lot of time walking around looking for squirrels on hunts. And the short version is that I learned a tremendous amount about the woodlands and forests of Vermont and other flora and fauna that was out there, including like mushroom hunting. I got really good at a lot of that because I wasn't so good at squirrel hunting. But after a few years, I know it's pretty funny. I make a joke about it every year. It took me 4 hunts this year to actually succeed, and that's the best year yet. Usually I go out about 6 or 8 times before I succeed. But what's happened now is I have a lot better idea where to look, and I have a lot more patience. And this year on the 4th try out, I succeeded, and people get a chance to look at it. I showed people how I did it and, you know, how I turned that into food. And that's been, a very popular thing with people in Vermont, I think especially this year when food security is really in the forefront of people's minds.
This is, you showed it on Instagram, right?
That's right, yep.
Yep. How do folks find your,
The Green Neck, which is a sort of play on redneck and being in Vermont. The Green Neck on Instagram.
Yeah, the Green Neck, okay.
What I've also been doing is I work with Fish and Wildlife, and we're creating stories about wild food, which Fish and Wildlife will feature, I think, primarily on Instagram, but maybe on Facebook too. And the idea there is to show people like a dish that came from wild foods in Vermont, and then they add a little voiceover, which is the story about, you know, how you found the food or what was going on, how you got on your hunt or where you're fishing and turned that into food, which I think is really going to help people. We're trying to help people feel more comfortable with the idea of wild food, you know, going from the woods to the table.
In the now with squirrels, since that seems to be a favorite, I would think you would need multiple squirrels to really make a meal for a family, no? Because they're kind of small.
I think so. That's a fair thought. Gray squirrels, I would say, tend to be about a pound to a pound and a half. And I made one of the things I like to make each year is what's called the Brunswick stew, which is a traditional American recipe from the Mid-Atlantic region, which is can be made with all different game, but it's quite traditionally made with squirrels. And to make a good-sized batch to feed 8 people, 3 or 4 squirrels is needed for that. What I found is like in that particular dish, that's as much a harvest like stew as it is a meat stew. So it has lots of potatoes and tomatoes and whatnot. So I often like to think as a squirrel as going to be part of a dish that has like soup-like ingredients or stew-like ingredients. So the squirrel doesn't have to fill out the whole meal. It's just the protein that adds the flavor to it.
Yeah, and talk to me about flavor, because I must say, just personally, I don't think I've ever had squirrel. I'm a little bit skeptical.
Okay, that's a great question to ask, and I will be the first to admit that I was skeptical, and I don't want to talk about other creatures, but when I started hunting, there were a lot of things like squirrel that I had never had before, and I couldn't find anybody who was going to serve me some. So when I got my first squirrels, it was really up to me to figure out what to do with that beyond, you know, recipes I found on the internet. And I do collect older game cookbooks, and there were a lot of recipes there. But because I have a cooking background, I kind of, my approach to squirrels were to not try to make them into the food that you get at, your typical favorite chain restaurant, but instead to cook them as simply as possible. So in the beginning, I essentially just slow cooked things. Like, a squirrel is a very active creature, and so it's got a pretty well developed musculature. To me, that usually means you're going to cook it at a lower temperature for a longer time to soften up the muscle tissue. What I found is squirrels, I think, like other animals of the forest, tend to taste a lot like the diet that they eat, and that differs from season to season and year to year. In the area where I tend to hunt squirrels, they tend to have excellent access to acorns, beechnuts, berries, insects, other kinds of things. And when they eat a broad and varied diet, I find the way I would describe it is a strength of flavor akin to the meat of a duck leg, for example. So if you've had a farm-raised duck before, it's dark in color, but it's moderate in flavor. But I don't find it to be, like, extremely gamey at all. In fact, in recent years, I have a friend who hosts a party in November with a Salvador Dali theme, you know, so people show up in strange costumes, and strange food has been a key theme for that for years. And I bring squirrel to that every year, and that environment tends to make people feel more comfortable. They're like, there's usually a lot of strange, unusual things to eat. Squirrel is kind of middle of the road at that party, and I've had at least 24 people try squirrel for the first time and be like, wow, gee, you know, okay, I would eat that again. So I regularly try to get people to try it, and those that do, I think, have a good reaction to it.
Now, one fairly serious question I would think comes up is squirrels are sometimes associated with diseases and rabies and this kind of thing. How do you, when you bring a squirrel home from the woods, how do you know that it's not going to make you sick?
Excellent question. And I can't say that I'm a complete expert on this, but my experience has been with squirrels is that because they're, you know, a healthy squirrel's life expectancy in Vermont is about 2 years. And so they have to be fairly healthy and be in a fairly good spot diet-wise to be able to survive at all. So my thinking has typically been that if you actually see one out there and you're able to take it while you're hunting, there's a really good chance it's a healthy squirrel to begin with, because ones that aren't healthy have already been preyed upon or died for other reasons. But then because you have to process them yourself after, you know, because they are small, I have processed quite a number of them, you start to develop a feel for how the animal should look and feel when you start to break it down. And I have to admit, I have had a couple that I chose not to eat because I had concerns about the way it looked and the way it felt. Yeah. But generally, because I am cooking them, you know, low and slow, as I said, they are extremely well cooked by the time I get to eating them. And the research, you know, backup research that I've done on the internet and talking to biologists has made me feel very good about that concern. Rabies is always a concern, but typically, you know, a rabies-infected animal doesn't behave in the normal way, and so it's really pretty unusual to actually take an animal that has rabies. The other thing I have encountered is tuberculosis. I did have one example of a squirrel with tuberculosis, and I'm not going to explain that on the radio, but once you are trained to know what that looks like, you'll never make a mistake if you start to process an animal that has tuberculosis.
I see. Okay. Talk to me a little bit about other animals that you might hunt. I mean, I'm thinking if you're after squirrels, what about, I don't know, chipmunks or minks or weasels or any other small animals?
Yep. So I think in terms of priority, so part of it is the seasonality. So right now in Vermont, squirrel, bear, and geese are the only things you can hunt that are under management. Excuse me. Red squirrels can also be hunted in Vermont, and they're not under management, so they don't have a specific season. I do hunt them. Chipmunks, you could hunt, but they, so I'm told, aren't worth it taste-wise. I'll probably find out eventually if I ever end up taking one. But other animals coming into season, so this Saturday, cottontail season opens, and so rabbits are open to be hunted. And also it's the opening for ruffed grouse, which is not a mammal, but a bird. Because of the nature of the habitat where they live, it's conceivably possible to be hunting all three at the same time. In fact, some of my colleagues at Fish and Wildlife and I have been hunting together for squirrels, and starting on Saturday, we'll be hunting for squirrels, rabbits, and grouse all at the same time. Other small game that can be hunted in Vermont, snowshoe hare, which is not a rabbit, but similar and bigger. Those tend to be in higher elevations in the mountains. You can also hunt woodchucks, which are quite delicious and fairly common. I think you did mention there are some... we do have both a trapping and hunting season for raccoon in Vermont. And while we don't have a lot of time to talk about it, raccoon was a food that I was very skeptical of. And last year, a friend of mine took a raccoon that was causing some problems on his property. And he and his son skinned it for a hat. And I took the carcass and made a stew out of it. And much like my first experience with squirrel, it was excellent. And
wow.
People really.
Well, John Gaunter, unfortunately, we are about out of time, but I do appreciate you checking in with us. This is fascinating. I didn't really know this was a thing that much out there, but there it is, hunting small game in Vermont. We're going to talk about it some more after the break. John's going to take off. We got another Dave Furman's going to join us, and then we're going to be talking to a chef in the last part of the program this morning. So stay with us, folks.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Dilly takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We've been talking about hunting small game in Vermont, and interesting conversation with John Gaunter there in the last quarter hour, talking about hunting squirrel and cooking them up in stews. And I don't know, I don't think I've ever had squirrel, and maybe I need to be a more adventurous eater. I did try an interesting dish. Actually, last year, my wife and I went up to Montreal. This, of course, back before the COVID, when you still could do that. And we went out to Montreal for the weekend to celebrate a birthday or something. We went out to eat, and I had wild boar, which was absolutely delicious. It was a nice mushroom sauce. But I said to my wife afterward, I said, "So if you are what you eat, am I pretty wild or am I kind of a boar?" I don't know. Anyway, we are hoping to be speaking in the next couple of minutes with Dave Furman, another hunter of small game in Vermont, and someone who is very interested in recruiting and attracting new folks to the whole hunting line activity, shall we say, in our great state here in Vermont. And He so far has not appeared. We'll hope that he can join us very, very shortly. Meanwhile, I'm wondering if listeners out there have had experience in hunting small game. We understand from some communication we had yesterday from Lewis Porter, the Commissioner of Fish and Wildlife, that Dave's an accomplished hunter, including grouse and woodcock. So it sounds like he likes the birds, and wondering if folks out there, when you go out hunting, do you mainly go for the sort of very popular traditional deer, or do you like to try to find a moose, or are you someone who is hunting the small stuff, and including squirrels in the case of John Gaunter, our just previous guest here on the Dave Graham Show. WDEV, FM, and AM, give us a ring. Talk to us about your hunting experiences, any small game you might have captured, any favorite recipes you have. We're going to be talking a little bit later in this last half hour of the program this morning with Doug Payne. He is a chef at the Hotel Vermont and a very accomplished chef from what we understand. And Doug has a lot of skill at cooking fish and game and foraged foods, and we're going to be finding out maybe from him what a good thing to do if you happen to come home with a with a raccoon. I guess you make the pelt into a hat. This is something that John Gaunter was talking about just before the break, and then you got some raccoon meat on your hands, and what do you do with that? Do you fry it up? Do you put it in a stew? Do you roast it? Do you put it in the smoker? I'm sure there's all sorts of different approaches you can take to cooking any of these small game meats. But I'm also really curious about woodcock and grouse. I've never tried. Maybe I need to branch out a little bit and get a little more adventurous in what I eat. But the show is really devoted today to this very interesting discussion about hunting small game in Vermont. So if you have experiences with that, we're happy to hear you out here at WDEV. 244-1777 is the local number in Waterbury. The toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255 or 291-TALK. And this is a field that you know, one of the great things I really enjoy about doing this is I get to learn something new every day frequently about different aspects of life here in our great state. And I'm not a hunter personally myself. I don't have any philosophical opposition to it as some people do, but I also don't have the keenest eyesight, so I'd be out there wondering, is that a raccoon or is that a chipmunk? So I think we have a caller on the line from Bradford, and I'm sorry, I missed a name. Can you tell us what's your name?
Gary Moore.
Gary, how are you doing?
Oh, not too bad. Working in the woods today.
Oh, good. So are you a hunter of small game?
I am.
Wow. What do you like to get?
Well, certainly partridge or rough grouse, but partridges is what we call them around here. Gray squirrel and snowshoe hare.
Wow. Okay.
You were talking about cooking, and
yeah.
That's what got my head. I take and usually put them in the freezer, and then when I get two or three gray squirrel, two or three partridge, and perhaps a rabbit or two or a hare, my wife makes a delicious game pie. Just the same way you'd make a chicken pie, with biscuits and gravy. The three meats together complement one another, and to me, it's delicious.
Wow. Huh. That actually does sound pretty good.
All three of the species we're talking about, you know, are relatively small, so individually, it's pretty hard to make much of a meal out of them, at least for more than one person. But you put them together, and you got a good quantity of meat and a delicious game pie.
That's something. When was the last time you had a game pie?
About a year ago.
Yeah, and hoping to be able to have another one this fall, are you?
Oh, yeah. Once I get done next year's wood, then I'll be able to get out hunting a little bit, I hope, soon.
Yeah, right, right. Hey, I'm wondering, actually, in terms of the time devoted to hunting, have you found yourself doing more of that this year with the COVID going on? You know, a lot of people have a lot of time on their hands because they're not working as much or whatever. They're not going out and doing other stuff and that kind of thing. What do you find there?
In my case, no, a lot less. In fact, I have not been hunting this deer, and what worse yet, I haven't been fishing.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
You know,
I've been really busy.
Speaking of fishing, you mentioned that oftentimes if you hunt and you get a small animal, a squirrel or something, or even one of the birds, a woodcock or a grouse or a partridge, it's not enough for a meal just to get one. You gotta kind of add them up for a bit. And I find that with fish too. There's times when I'll go out and I'll catch a fish and I'll get it back to the house or whatever, and I've got it on the, you know, ready to fillet it, and boy, there's not a whole lot here in one fish.
Same thing. I often will freeze fish until I've got enough that I want or whatever. Especially true with ice fishing for perch and other panfish. You get a bunch of them, and then later have friends around for a fish fry. It might be months later because they freeze pretty well.
That is a good thing, and I love a nice fish meal, that tasty stuff. So, Gary, thank you for the call. I appreciate
regarding,
you. Go ahead.
Regarding your comment about a lot of people fishing. Though I haven't, certainly are a lot of people out fishing. One of my younger brothers lives to fish. I mean, he literally fishes 130 days a year normally. And he said every place he goes, they're just crowded with fishermen, the normal places he goes. In fact, he's up Greenville, Maine, on Moosehead Lake, fishing some of the ponds up there right now. And I heard from him 2 days ago, and he said there were just the usual pools and along the river are very crowded. And I know that's the case here. And I was up in Pittsburgh, New Hampshire, and then across an Arrow a week ago, and the same thing there. Fishermen are everywhere.
Wow, that's amazing. You know, you think you're going to keep your social distancing and stuff with this COVID thing, and you go out and out to some wooded stream bank, and you're realizing, wow, it's tough to stay 6 feet apart. Might get your lines tangled, if nothing else. So, hey, yeah. Gary, I really appreciate the call. I got to move along, but thank you so much for checking in with us. It's good talking with you. Not only do we now have Dave Furman from he's a board member of Vermont's chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. They focus on the conservation aspect of hunting, but he's also very involved in the recruitment of new hunters, including adult onset hunters. And that's interesting because John Gaunter, our first guest in this segment back around 10:15, was one of those adult onset hunters, folks who take up hunting not as a kid, but when they're all grown up. And so we have Dave Furman joining us. And Dave, thank you very much for getting on the phone with us this morning.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Doug Payne is also on the phone. He's the chef at the Hotel Vermont in Burlington, described as one of the top chefs in Vermont, and he has a lot of skill at cooking fish and game and foraged foods. And you gotta cook local in Vermont. People expect the local foods here. Doug Payne, thank you very much for joining us this morning as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let me start with Dave, if I could. Dave Furman, what are your favorite things to hunt out there?
Well, probably the most enjoyment I get is partridge hunting. Ruffed grouse, people know them as. And that's it's something that people can find really easily across most of Vermont, the region. And I think they're really accessible because you don't have to get up early. You don't have to be quiet. You can just go for a walk in the woods. A lot of people have really good access to some really good grouse hunting. So there's some great public land available. There's plenty of private land available. And it's a really good eating bird. It's fun to get out, whether you get any or not. It's just a good time.
That's great. And Doug Payne of the Hotel Vermont, have you ever had grouse on the menu up there?
Not technically on the menu. We've served some at a wild game dinner series that we used to do with the Fish and Wildlife Department. You can't legally have wild game on your menu, but when you have a sponsored event like that, you can.
Yeah, I see, huh? And what do you think, Doug, is the best way to prepare grouse?
Just slow roasting. You know, I think with a lot of you want to focus on the slow cooking, because they could be a little tougher than your supermarket meat, but way more taste.
That's interesting. Way more taste, and it's so much of our many of our local foods, including hunted foods, just do have an extra element of freshness to them, and it really brings out you know what you're eating, because it definitely speaks to you that way. It's a wonderful experience frequently, and Dave, when you go out hunting for grouse, I think I saw that you are someone who likes to introduce other folks who are not hunters to the sport. Do you sometimes bring rookies along with you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really accessible for a lot of people. There's a lot of different ways to do it. I have a dog. There's various kinds of dogs people will use for it that, you know, are bred. That's kind of what they do. Mm-hmm. And then plenty of people can do it without. And so it's something that's really accessible for people. And can be approached a lot of ways. And at the same time, you go out and you can run into rabbits and squirrels and stuff that are also really good eating. So it's an easy way for somebody to get their feet wet and have a good time at the same time.
Now, you say you have a dog. What kind of dog do you have?
I have a lab.
Uh-huh. And you find that that breed particularly good on for hunting? I mean, they're retrievers, so they would go get it for you, right?
Yep, there's people use either, they call flushing dogs or pointing dogs. They're both great. I really appreciate just dogs in general. So I have friends that have labs, Springer Spaniels, pointers, setters, and they all have great things about them. They're mostly just personal preference.
I have a Cocker Spaniel. Would that work?
Yeah, Cocker Spaniels are actually bred specifically as hunting dogs, so they've got it in them.
Huh. I frequently think of this dog as being too goofy to do anything useful, but maybe I'm wrong. And he's not quite 3 years old. Too late to train, or could I still train him to do this?
Without getting into the weeds, it's easier if they're, if it's done from a younger age, but for sure it's possible. And, you know, most dogs have it. It's just genetically part of what they are. So it really takes more direction than training.
Right. I see. Yeah. That's interesting. Doug, I'm wondering, are you a hunter as well as a chef, or, do you just wait to have somebody else bring you the meat to cook?
These days I wait for somebody else. I hunted a lot when I was a kid, but I haven't in many years.
Uh-huh. And as a chef, does it bring you particular joy to cook something that is out of the woods as opposed to out of a freezer or supermarket meat counter?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like you said earlier, the taste is way better, but just the connection to the land and the heritage of it is great, and it's also super healthy. So
yeah, that's folks right now, of course, with our economy and having such a bumpy ride with the coronavirus and everything, I'm hearing from people that that hunting is a good way to, supplement the food supply, because obviously if you're out of work and you're worried about where next week's grocery money's coming from, there's a way to at least supplement what you're doing for your diet. So, wow, that's important. Yeah, important consideration as well. Dave, as you've been out hunting in the woods, We had a caller on earlier talking about fishing, and he was saying that all of his favorite fishing spots are really crowded because a lot of people are out there fishing who maybe would normally be at work. We just talked about people being out of work. Are you finding a lot more hundreds in the woods, Dave?
Well, many of the seasons have opened in September. So people are out hunting squirrels. There's a bear season. I have personally seen a lot of people out in the woods, but not a ton of hunters. I think one of the best things about Vermont is just the amount of access that people have between state wildlife management areas, some of the state forests, public land, town forests. You know, there's some federal land, the national forests. People have access to a huge amount of area, including some of the lake where there's waterfowl and fish.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really pretty easy for most people to go out and say, you know, what's going to be the most fun on this particular day and go find that and not be shoulder to shoulder with people. It's really quite a good place for that. So,
yeah,
I'm not worried.
Okay. Well, in terms of the multiple opportunities out there, I think one of our earlier guests was talking about the fact that you can go out hunting for grouse and get a rabbit instead. And I'm wondering, one thing I meant to ask him and didn't, so I'll ask you, what about gear? Do you want different gear to get different species?
I mean, yes and no. Yes, there is some requirement for different species in order to make an ethical shot. You don't want an animal to suffer, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some requirements. So waterfowl, for instance, requires non-toxic shot. A lot of people choose to use that anyway, just for versatility's sake. But outside of matching the size shot or whatever to the game that you're shooting, so it's enough to do it in an ethical way, you can really do it as much or as little as you want. You can go overboard and get all the gear, modern stuff and vests and boots and pants and whatnot. Or
yep.
You can just throw on a pair of jeans and a pair of boots and go out in the woods. So it's not a requirement. And for anyone who's just getting into it to get their feet wet and try it out, some good warm clothing and a piece of orange and, a shotgun or 22 for small game and you're in business.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. In terms of the gear, I'll tell you, was poking fun at a friend of mine not long ago where, he got a boat and a trailer and he got all his, fishing tackle and et cetera, et cetera. And, there's a little expense for the license. And I said, boy, by the time you go out, you catch a fish, it's going to be $400 a pound. But
yeah. If you approach it that way, it's not it becomes a lifestyle. And like, Doug was saying, it's really a connection to where people are. When I say lifestyle, it's everything from what you do on your time off to what you think about to how you spend time with family, how you cook and how you eat. And it really is a real connection to place all the way around.
Right. I will say I was trying to be a wise guy, that's sort of, I know what you're saying and I concur. I don't mean to really denigrate it. Just sort of, kind of a strange irony sometimes when you consider just the pure numbers, it's, but yeah.
I recommend not quantifying it
that way. Yeah, absolutely. Doug Fain, I want to ask you a fishing question, which is, what are your favorite, local species of fish to cook?
Well, lake trout is great. Mm-hmm. It's one of the bigger ones, so you can kind of, do a little more with it. You can grill it. You can, pan fry it, sear it. Perch tastes great. It's really light and flaky. Definitely better in the winter than in the summer.
Right.
But yeah, all trout is really tasty.
Wow. Well, gentlemen, we're about out of time, but I really want to thank you both very much, as well as my previous guest, John Gaunter, for coming on. Dave Furman, Doug Payne, excellent conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Alrighty. Hey, fast approaching the top of the hour, which means the end of today's edition of the Dave Graham Show here at WDEV, FM and AM. Join us again tomorrow morning for another another edition of our show, and stay tuned now for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio. Have a good afternoon, everybody.